Today's guest is Professor Brendan Gleeson, who's made a significant contribution to urban and social policy through his work at the University of Melbourne. So today we'll be talking about cities, the history of cities and the future of cities. His ideas about where and how we're going to navigate the future of cities is going to be really, really interesting. And we've had many discussions in the past about this topic. So I think his insights and his ideas are going to be really fruitful for this conversation. So welcome, Brendan. I'm really grateful that you've joined us on this podcast on light, cities and architecture. So would you like to introduce yourself to people who may not know you very well?
Thanks, Anthony, and it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. Well, I'm an academic. That's what I've been for most of my adult life and career. A few other little bits and bobs, a year in the Reserve Bank. And
I never knew that.
Early along the way. Yeah, it was a bit of a wake and fright experience in those days. But basically, I've gone through a track of being a planning and geography academic for most of my adult life. My current appointment is Professor of Urban Planning at the University of Melbourne. I have been on leave for the last couple of years.
And you've taken up poetry, I believe.
Taken up a bit of poetry, yeah. So my intention is to go back to the job at the end of the year, all going well. But yeah, I needed a bit of a career break. And in that time, some other interests have come to the fore, most particularly poetry. And I've written a number of books on Australian cities and things, but it's always been said along the way that there was a sort of poetic cast about the writing, so which I always felt, oh, that's a nice thing to say because I've always had an interest in poetry, but I finally had a chance to get my teeth into poetry, including the city of Melbourne.
Well, I've got your book in my hand, so no doubt we will talk about the poetry. But I guess the reason I've invited you, we've known each other for quite some time because we've got mutual friends and a circle of friends that coexist. But I've always been fascinated with the discussions that we've had about cities and about urban design. In a funny sort of a way, I think we probably trained at the same school, at the architecture school at Melbourne University. Yep. And I think our lives have sort of led very different paths, but we've both educated at the same place. I went on to do, well, I've done architecture, practice architecture, and you've done urban design, urban planning and urban geography. And I guess the conversations that we've had around cities has been really fascinating. So I guess that's the reason why I've invited you here. So let's start with a question, a fairly simple question. In your mind, what is a city? Because we have towns, we have settlements, we have, you know, a whole range of things. But what in your mind, what constitutes a city?
Well, there are several possible answers to that question. I'll try and be brief. We have an answer to that in the British Commonwealth, which is, you know, an urban agglomeration that has a cathedral and then it's been granted by Buckingham Palace a city status. There's a framing of it around that, but you probably need to pay attention to. That's one reason we have Lord Mayors in some of our cities in Australia and all that kind of thing. So there's been that points to power, I think. You know, cities are concentrations of effusions of power. They assert power. But, you know, apart from that, and obviously and principally, they're concentrations, well, of politics, but of economy and people, economic activity. You know, they've been the means by which they've been incredibly important to humanity, which we've liberated ourselves from just grubbing and toil and have been able to organise more complex divisions of human labour and economic systems. But they always come with power.
So, I mean, I was recently in Rome and I was just struck by the infrastructure that was in Rome, the aqueducts, the sewerage system, the roadways and things like that. It seems to me that the idea of a city has its own allure, like that it attracts people, it brings people to that urban centre and it takes people away from that sort of agrarian, you know, past. Is that sort of how you see it as well, or do you see it as power as the main thing that distinguishes cities from a township?
Well, I would underline both, power for sure, but through important stages of our history, a kind of liberating and inclusive power too. So if we think back through the European tradition, cities, you know, they had the injunction over them, Stadt, Luft, Macht frei, you know, the city air made you free, because if you were able to stay in a city for more than a year, I can't remember how many days it was, but you were then freed of your feudal bonds and servitude, and the city guaranteed that. So they were machines for freedom.
Okay.
For many people moving in, and, you know, they weren't just about the guilds and professions and ever more complex division of labour and, again, power. But they were machines for conferring freedom on people seeking that and leaving the sort of stultifying world of villages and agrarian areas. Not to say they're always bad all the time, but, you know, they've... Human ambition has always, you know, moved like a tide towards cities.
I guess one of the things that has been critical to the development of cities is really the health and safety of its inhabitants, because early days they were not places that were really healthy to live in. I think we've talked about in the past the way in which Melbourne has developed and the sewerage system, the roadway system and things like that. So as a place of organisation, it really needs to get those basic things right, does it not?
It does, and we've many instances in human history where they haven't. We think of the hellfire, disease-ridden cities of the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. It's early Victorian, before the, you know, slum and health reformers pushed changes that made those cities, which were really quite deadly places to be, partly because they were caught up in a wider palimpsest of power, you know, the colonial... British colonial system, and through that came back all these diseases from that those populations hadn't known before, cholera, typhoid and the like. They were sort of visited upon those urban populations who lived in exploitative and insanitary conditions. So there came a point where I think, you know, the middle class, the reforming middle class there, pursued what we might call enlightened self-interest. And they said, if we don't do something about this, we're all going to go. And then, you know, there were humanitarian arguments, but there were also economic efficiency arguments. There's no way to run a city. You
know, how did those changes come about? I mean, when you think about the concentration of power, the idea of putting in a sewerage system, the idea of getting light and air down at street level, was all of this through... I mean, the thing that struck me about when I was in Europe recently was this idea of, and we talked about this, about the idea of a social contract, the idea that certain things should be done. Is that something that evolves over a centuries, or how do you imagine that those sorts of things actually occur?
Well, in the instance that we're talking about, which is our own recent history over the last two centuries, that is to say in the European history, and we can go to outside that in this discussion too, but that'll bring it right back to Melbourne. I think, as I said, I think it was enlightened self-interest amongst the reforming classes, but also rising anger and activism and assertion from the working classes who fought for better conditions, including better ways to live in cities and fairer conditions. We can't ignore that there was a fair bit of class struggle that went on with that. The other thing I would add about Australian cities is they have quite a sort of military part of their background and assertion, because they were colonial powers, colonial cities, and we've had quite a history, which we don't often think about, of sort of militarised government. And you know, even up until a relatively recent history in the 20th century, the heads of premiers could have been ex-generals.
Yeah.
They weren't called premiers in the Colonial Secretary's Department. So I think that actually went in our favour. They got on and did stuff, right? So Melbourne got reticulated fresh water before London did.
Yeah.
And that's part of that, the assertion of centralised power, that in those instances certainly went in favour of the human populations.
Can you talk a little bit about the city plan of Melbourne? I mean, we will dwell on Melbourne somewhat because we're both from Melbourne, I suspect. The Hoddle grid, it's straight lines. It's a really, when you think about military, it's a very rational idea, isn't it? It seems to come out of some kind of 17th, 18th century idea about what cities should look like, an ideal city. It's certainly not an organic city, but it seems to have this idea of wide streets, very much a grid formation. There were no city squares. I believe that was due to they didn't want people congregating and doing that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about the early history of Melbourne?
I wouldn't say that I'm the greatest expert on that, but I know a bit about it. And what I would say is that rectilinear pattern, we can trace back to the sort of Roman era. And again, it has a sort of military power assertion about it. I mean, if you want to run a place properly, you run it rectilinear, not having hidey holes for malfeasance, right? Or people stacked up in places that are difficult to get to, where they can come pouring out at the night and belt everyone on the head. So I think from the beginning, there was a, you know, Melbourne's a very different, because it was established nearly 50 years after Sydney. So that thinking had started to settle in place, right? I mean, the Parisians, that is the power in Paris, looked on enviously on these rectilinear cities and then got to work to copy that through Haussmann's, you know, regularisation, great term, of Paris, which is a massive exercise of brutalisation.
Sure, in a way. And can you just talk a little bit about that? That's where, you know, large sections of the city were bulldozed to put in those boulevards.
Yes, and, you know, I think it had several dimensions to it, sort of overdetermined, as we used to say, but I think there was, on the front of it, they would say this is about making these places more healthy, right, and securing the health of populations rather than these crowded and sanitary and difficult to get to when there were fires and things like that, right? So they had that. But it was at least about the assertion of military and civil governance power and the rising affluence of the, you know, the middle class, right, who wanted to be seen in boulevards and wanted to live that kind of life, and the conspicuous consumption of wealth in a certain Parisian way. But you just can't discount at its heart was a big sort of military strategy to deal with the left bank in Paris. And they would have had in mind the French Revolution, which was only still within 100 years of what had happened, and the restiveness and unruliness, it would have been seen as crowded urban inner populations. So when we get to Melbourne, they've already got that in mind. But also there's a softening in that, I think, by a genuine commitment to, you know, they had these theories about miasma and bad air and odours and all that kind of stuff. So that was, some of that proved to be hokum in terms of science.
The idea that buildings should be spaced apart, wide streets, lead to better health outcomes.
That was the idea. And I'm sure, not being a public health expert, I'm sure there's a level of truth to that. The deep science about miasma and effluvia was probably not, although who did want to live in all the stink, marvellous Smellbourne, as it was called, from Sydney. I mean, it's hard to imagine now just how horrific a lot of that was, the tanning and those industries along the Yarra and into the city, and the way people lived cheek by jowl with that. So I think there was a genuine, you know, assertion of a public health agenda there, as well as control, order, good Victorian values. Plus also, they had to drive cattle through a lot of the streets. That was still going on into the 20th century. There was a practical reason why some of those streets were wide, as they were moving goods, equipment, but also, you know, as I said, cattle and sheep.
The thing that I find remarkable about Melbourne is how quickly it developed. From the 1850s through to what the late 1880s, it was rapid. You know, the amount of building that went on and just how quickly it grew on the back of gold. What are your views on that rapid expansion? Can't imagine another city that would have expanded so quickly.
Yes, you're right to say that. My senior colleague, the esteemed colleague Graham Davison, who wrote the book The Rise and Fall of Marvellous Melbourne a good while ago, and I recommend it to anyone who wants to understand Melbourne, its growth and its origins. But it did grow. I mean, all the conditions were sort of propitious for the rapid growth of a city here, right? So there was the gold rush, the massive infusion of population. It was a long way to go once that was over. So there was a kind of hanging around part of that, I think. But I think just that infusion of capital and wealth, and the landscape was good for development. It was flat. It was a lot easier than Sydney and other places. And away they went, the land boomers. And other things fell into place, like the building of railways in Melbourne. So suburbanisation was achieved through railways. And this is something my late friend, the great Paul Mees, used to point out often to people to think about Melbourne. Think about, you know, we need to get public transport back. Sure, but in fact, the suburbanisation, and we often think of suburbanisation as sort of the antithesis of public transport. In fact, it's not. We can talk more about that. But Melbourne grew along railways, speculative railways, eventually taken over by the state. Those things came together and, yeah, it grew very rapidly. By the 1880s, it had a rateable land value that was, I think, third only to London and Glasgow in the empire.
So the railway lines that went out past Northcote, Thornbury, you know, all those sort of places in a whole range of areas, it sort of like created these veins that led from the city centre outwardly. So it created a very strong sense of the city being very important. It was almost like the metropolis. And then you had these suburban places, suburbs, outlying from that.
Indeed. It's a very monocentric pattern. And that early suburbanisation of the middle classes in Melbourne, and this is a pattern that was repeated in the British Isles and then in North America, that early suburbanisation was driven by the middle class moving out, having... And there was a whole philosophy about more virtuous ways to live in suburbia, and also, you know, it was very much the sort of middle-class nuclear family, and but it was monocentric. So the idea was that largely the men were working in the city, and then they'd catch trains home to these well-ordered, contented families where they would have always kind of cleansing domestic peace.
So that was repeated in America as well, in the US.
Absolutely,
I mean, watching Mad Men, that there's that vision of, you know, the men going into the city and their wives being at home. It was a very, that was the suburban life. That was how it was for a number of years.
And it developed in Melbourne and continued through the 20th century to epic scale. I mean, some of your listeners may know John Brack's great painting, Collins Street, 5 p.m. So by the time we get into the 50s, it's like vast hordes of people are coming in on trains and then leaving at the end of the day. And you'll see in that painting, by that stage, women are there as well, right? Yep. But I mentioned Reserve Bank earlier. So in about 1982, I joined those hordes moving, going in and going out. And
well, they're still happening. I mean, let's face it, whether you're driving in or you're on the train, you're still, a lot of people still do descend on the city to work and then leave at the end of the day.
That's right. But increasingly over the last decades, Melbourne has become more diffuse and polycentric.
Do you really believe that? Because, I mean, when you say polycentric, you mean a number of centres, like I suppose you're referring to, say, like Dandenong or Footscray. Is that what you're sort of referring to?
I am. Such places. When I say polycentric, I don't mean well-planned polycentric.
Sure.
I mean, you know, that's why I use the term diffusion, because a lot of it's just sort of market-driven dispersion, and that's a big problem for us.
Mm.
We've allowed the market to dictate that dispersion far too much. And that does lead to sprawl, and that's a term I use very advisedly, but unmanaged dispersion. But if you look at the whole entity of metropolitan Melbourne, it's a vast metropolitan region now. It must be getting on towards 5.5 million people. There just has been a great amount of dispersion for practical reasons. You know, it's just not, the economy won't function and other things won't function by having everyone coming into the city. And you can break down the stats and look at that. And the pandemic has made all these cards go back up into the air, of course.
Yeah.
But we still are left with the infrastructure of a very monocentric city, which increasingly doesn't suit the needs of the population, not just the economic needs, but for cross-city travel and the like.
It is quite difficult to go from, you know, I guess, say, I don't know, St Kilda to Footscray, you know, by public transport. It's actually, it's much easier to come in and then go out. It's quite difficult to travel around the city.
It is, yeah. We're left with this trip making exactly on public transport in and out.
In and out,
which is really, you know, my son who's 27, I'm amazed, and he won't mind me manage this, he does that in and out. He's been back staying with me for a couple of months in North Melbourne, but he'll catch the 57 into the city and then out to some great suburban area. Though he's now just discovered a few buses that do actually go cross country. But that's the logic of the state building the suburban rail loop, which is about that. And also to assert some planned dispersion, you know, to have concentration around that cross-city infrastructure.
Do you want to talk about COVID and how that changed the city? Because I know that you've said to me that it's a bit of a taste of what things might be like in the future. But really, COVID changed the city quite dramatically. Now, a lot of people now work from home. There's a lot of unoccupied buildings in the city. Has that changed the way we view the city in your views?
Well, I wish we'd have more discussion about it. When you say, has it changed the way we view cities? I think it's changed the way a lot of individuals think about cities, but we haven't had much collective discussion about what that's meant. So I underline that. We need more of that.
Hmm.
And hopefully that's something you can pick up in this series. Because I think we're still working out what happened with COVID.
Yeah.
And now there's a struggle on that. Some firms and other, you know, entities are saying, you know, people shouldn't be working from home, and they're making larger sort of economic and employment threats about that situation. But I think what happened then was, it was a, and I don't mean at all, we must foreground the horror of that pandemic, and so many people passed away or were left injured. My own mother passed away from COVID during that time. But on the other side of it, and there's always a ledger in these things, on the other side of it, the brass linings in the cloud, you might say, I think people rediscovering their local areas, and those under lockdown, we all say we didn't like lockdown, but a lot of people did in a sort of quiet way. In my neighbourhood in North Melbourne, the birds came back, there was music all day because there were so few cars. And people were out and about, and you'd see fathers in the park opposite, which you didn't see that much of before. I don't mean to be too essentialist about that, but there was something good went on as well. And I think a lot of people discovering, oh, I can work from home.
The idea of community has become a really important theme, hasn't it, in recent times. People are really trying to reconnect with a smaller group of people, it seems to me.
Yes, I don't know how that would work out in the whole sociology of that, but I think that's certainly part of what's happened. I mean, so I think there's a class of people who can work at home.
The laptop
there's a massive
class
who can't, right? Cause, and home is problematical now, ever more so with the rental crisis, the housing crisis. So there's a certain section or segment of the population for whom, you know, there was a kind of bit of a gift in the whole situation to discover and then to be able to assert. State government's accepted that, is allowing, you know, that's a big workforce, a chunk of them to stay at home during the week for so many days a week. But, you know, the idea that it was liberating or that that was a great idea for everyone is not true. But crises or, you know, threats and challenges seem to be coming in quicker succession now. Like, we've only just coming out of that pandemic. Yeah. I mean, it's still, COVID is still killing people.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible. I mean, it's essentially 2 years of our lives where we were in lockdown, not lockdown. We were all scared of going out. The thing that strikes me about it is how much of it is being put to bed, how much of it is in the past.
Yeah, I think there's a human will around that to put it behind us. And there's a politics around that. I mean, the state government, which was so assertive during that, and I thank them for that. There was a bit of pushback from below, but I think they generally did the right thing. All state governments, actually, and they acted well with the federal government during that time, largely. I think we haven't done enough thinking about it. It's still going on, the COVID. We now need to think that it's a precursor to more, right? And we know that, you know, public health and disease experts are telling us that other things are could be possible or even imminent. What we haven't thought about is where this rather freewheeling development we have in Melbourne in the last few decades, particularly the vertical sprawl in the cities and now increasingly out in suburban regional centres, are they safe and resilient places given that these sort of things, pandemics, are possible? And I think we would have to say no, they're not. And I think I can't see evidence even amongst urbanists, let alone state governments and developers, that we're prepared to have that discussion about that. I live in a beautifully architect-designed, medium-density, 30 units building in North Melbourne, but very apparent, you know, during the pandemic and the lockdown and the fear of getting ill, they are much more unsafe places than our suburban detached dwellings,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, this is not an argument that we all need to go back to suburban detached dwellings, right? To get out of my building, you've got to touch the green button to get out, right? To go up the stairs, you've got to hold the handles. To get in the lift, you've got to push the buttons. It's form a great, you know, exposure. It's difficult to manage.
Well, that was part of the issue with the Flemington flats, was it not? That you had a large group of people that were potentially at risk. I mean, as an example, let's not perhaps go there, but I guess what you're saying is densification has its challenges in these sort of circumstances.
And yes, well, the flats happened, but I'd be equally worried about, because we didn't hear what happened along Elizabeth Street, the awful towers that have been, awful stuff that's been inflicted on Melbourne through freewheeling development and state governments that have overwritten the city of Melbourne. Leanne Hoddle's study of all that, I think it's almost a decade now, on a Churchill Fellowship showed that we had some of the highest densities in the world compared to even Hong Kong and New York. Absolutely.
So you're talking
terrible.
about the precinct around the market, sort of east of Elizabeth Street between Swanston and Elizabeth and slightly north of La Trobe Street. There's a density there that is, you know, you need to see it to believe it. It's quite incredible, isn't it?
Should never have happened.
It has had a strange effect because on street level you just get this buzz of people that is incredible at all times of the day, which is unlike what I experienced of Melbourne when I was young. There's just so many people now in the CBD.
There are. I mean, that's a polyglot. I mean, they're coming from all sorts of places and angles. But the other thing to observe about those towers, and I walk in there frequently, is how car-dependent they are. Right? So we've produced, that's why I call that stuff vertical sprawl. I mean, everyone there has a car. And there's always constant queues to get in and out of the car parks in the city. So the idea, and this is, we urbanists have been arguing and debating this over the last few decades in Australia, that simply going to higher densities produces mechanically all these good effects, right? Like more use of public transport, more social interaction, less energy use has been proven, particularly with this market-driven sprawl, to be not the case. And in many ways, things have been worsened by the design of those, ill design of those places.
Well, the buildings themselves don't lend themselves to be environmentally friendly. They do rely on energy to keep them warm and cool. Like if you take power away from those buildings, they would be inhospitable. From a, you know, a detached home, from a terrace house, from a, you know, they can live, you can survive in those sort of conditions. So I look at those towers and wonder what they must be like in the depths of summer, you know, let's say 5 or 6 days where it's 45 degrees and over. They must just be, you know, very inhospitable.
Unless you just have the air conditioning going all day, which they do, right?
Yeah, which they do.
A block of flats, which was, I think, designed really well. We've got double glazing and good aspect and that kind of thing. Still difficult to get cross ventilation, and in those towers it's impossible. They're just sealed boxes, right?
Yeah, they are.
So you've got to use
mechanical ventilation,
air conditioning, or you're not going to last in those places. So how did that come about? And unfortunately, a lot of advocates of high density, well-meaning, sort of drove us in that direction. Then it meant sort of neoliberal market
Well, it coincided, didn't it?
Yeah,
that
the
you
two
have,
came together.
There was an architectural argument for densification, which fitted neatly with the economics, or, you know, people who could exploit the economics of that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think the pandemic actually, as I said, I'm not diminishing the human horror of that and the scale, but it sort of stopped that stuff a bit in its tracks too. I think there is more pause for thought.
So let's look at, like, the houses that I particularly like. I think the model of housing that I think works really well in Melbourne is terrace housing. You know, if you look at a suburban street in Carlton or, you know, St Kilda or any of the inner suburbs, you get quite, you know, really good density as far as I can tell. You get individual identity, so a front door, a window that faces onto a street, and you get housing that, you know, achieves a pretty good density. You then go out beyond that and you get sort of very large suburban blocks, you know, 500, 600, 700 square metres with a single house on it. That has its own, I think, good suburbs that were designed in the 40s and 50s are still great places to live. They have really good communities and things like that. And what are your views on the sort of middle ring suburbs and the outer suburbs?
You know, except those observations, you sort of stopped at the sort of 1950s, 60s, 70s. What we've had since the 1980s, it's another failure of this urban consolidation.
Well, I was going to get there, I must say, but let's go on.
You know, the houses on micro blocks in new suburban developments,
yeah, they're
the worst of everything.
They have a plastic feel about them. They have big house on a relatively small allotment. They're like caravans parked on a suburban street. There's very little urban design. Like with a sort of classic suburban suburb, you have courts, which were kind of strange in their own right, but you had sort of wavy streets. So you had kind of an interesting sort of landscape treatment. And a kind of an architecture that seemed to work, I think.
Yes, all that's right. But you also had green space, you know,
green space,
which is what you don't have in these new developments. And they've got this mask of, oh, we're doing the right thing, crowding everyone in out here in these hutches together. You know, the houses almost touch. And there's, you know, micro court backyards and very little room on the streets for trees and for all these things are going to bake like hell in the, you know, so you've got a sort of low density, well, that's actually quite high dwelling densities. And that's an important distinction we need to make. Bringing it back into those, you were saying the Victorian terrace areas. I agree, they're generally wonderful, although I think some of them are a bit difficult in winter conditions because I think they were designed in an era where people had fires going during the days. Even servants to tend them.
That is true. I mean, often people will describe Australian housing as, you know, tents, you know, that they're very leaky. But what people don't appreciate is that there was a different form of heating and cooling that was used. I mean, there was really no cooling. So they tended to have lofty ceilings so that the heat could sort of escape. And they tended to have fires during the winter. So having a leaky space was actually desirable because you didn't want to die of, you know, carbon monoxide poisoning. So they were fairly efficient in their use of space. I mean, materials were, you know, difficult to obtain. So for their time, they were a response to the environment. They don't work quite so well today, but that's really no fault of the, you know, the people who built those buildings at that time.
you know, you being the architect are the expert on this, but I can see that many have been made to work better through renovations.
They certainly have,
even
yeah.
just light touch renovations that break open the roof and do interesting things and allow for other ways of heat and energy exchange. Look, I think it's important to also distinguish between dwelling density and population density. In some of those places now, you could make that observation around North Melbourne, they're beautiful, but they've got very low population densities.
You mean people living there?
Yeah. Because people age in place. And
yeah. The amount of time that's actually spent in those houses is actually quite low.
Yeah.
So a lot of those houses are actually vacant for long periods of time and you know, there aren't owner-occupied and a whole range of things are going on there, aren't they? I mean, I imagine this situation is actually even worse in places like London and Paris, where occupation rates are actually relatively low.
Yes, well, that's also a form of that is driven and complicated by investor housing now, whereas we think about investor housing and landlords and all that, but for a certain stratum, I don't have the figures in front of me, but it's more efficient for landlords and often people overseas, investors, to keep a place empty rather than have the bother of tenants. Mm. You know, there's a different kind of cultural and financial ambition going on there, which is just to secure a place and have it sitting there as an asset in a well-managed city and so forth. But so I think where we're heading with these points is the really terrible problem of vacancy in our cities. I mean, I think all this banging on, particularly the development sector, that there's a short supply of housing. There's over 11 million dwellings in Australia. It's enough. There should be enough if it was better distributed.
Yeah, it's you've got you've got a family, and they the rental crisis is a real problem, isn't it? It's actually very difficult to secure accommodation for young people or for anyone, really. Not just young people.
It's terrible. And I would underline for a moment, we're both fathers of young people. Awful intergenerational kind of theft and stymieing that's gone on for young people of all for most classes, middle class and below, I suppose. And we see it in our own children's lives through this totally out of sync housing market and stock that we've got. And I recommend, if people are still able to pull it up, but Tone Wheeler, the president of the Australian Institute of Architects, has got a fabulous piece in the newspaper today talking about this distended property market that we've allowed to happen and the growth of the rental class.
We've almost treated the house as a bank, a form of investment. I remember hearing at a lecture that there was a time where industrial land was much more expensive than housing, and I thought, of course it was, it was productive land, to put a factory onto a site would have meant that you were generating money. So of course it was of more value. But now that's just the reverse is true. Housing, the cost of housing in Australia is just so astronomically high. And the amount of money that we spend on our housing is incredibly high.
Well, it's been subject to a large degree of financialisation as much of the economy in the last decades. But a lot of that didn't happen naturally. It's driven by public policies that were wrong-headed. We can see that now. Negative gearing.
Negative
gearing. There's a wrong-headed policy. It should never... There were arguments that it would stimulate the growth of affordable rental sector driven, owned by landlords. I mean, I never thought that was a convincing argument, but many good-hearted people thought it was. And then there's the whole issue of capital gains and the other ways we tax and don't tax housing and have allowed it to become an investment vehicle, which comes with all sorts of other, social ambitions and costs that those chickens are coming home to roost as we speak.
Can you talk a little bit about what you see the future of cities with climate change, with hotter summers, colder winters? I mean, I remember you saying that COVID was almost an entree into what's likely to happen. Can you give some insight into, and I remember there was an article in The Age where you were quoted, which didn't paint a very pleasant picture. So I think before we go into a more optimistic picture, can you perhaps talk about the challenges that we face in cities?
Yes. I'll attempt to. I guess I have been writing about this for quite a while, about a decade now ago. I wrote a book called Lifeboat Cities where, the premise of that argument is we're largely an urbanised species now. In Australia, we got there early. And Graham Davison calls us the first suburban nation. Like we grabbed a hold of suburbia as a model like no other country early on. So The urban situation here has been defining. It's the centre stage of national life, although we've often denied that, you know, with all the bush ethos and myth and mythology. But we're a thoroughly urbanised and metropolitanised people. Metropolitan primacy here is not like anything else in the so-called Western world. You know, a large proportion of the population here lives in a very small group of what are now becoming quite large cities. So,
I mean, just to give that some context, for instance, if Melbourne were in the US, it would be something like, I think, the fifth or fourth largest city in the US. Yeah. So we often think of the US as being very urbanised, but in reality, they've got a lot of small cities, but really, you know, LA and New York are the two big ones. But, you know, Melbourne and Sydney would be very large metropolises in that context.
Yeah, they've got a more stretched scale with much larger amount of intermediate-sized cities, we might call them now. So swinging around, you know, the climate threat is going to, I would have said 10 years ago, is going to be met, and now I would say is being met or encountered in cities. It's a city. So I'm not diminishing at all what's going on in the, you know, in the rural areas, and we've had a lot of important attention to that with the horrific bushfires, the stress on the Murray-Darling Basin. The vast majority of Australians live in the metropolitan capitals. So I said the choice is really to allow us to continue marching backwards into a kind of a bad fate with climate change and the other. And we now know, I wouldn't have thought about pandemics then, but we know more of that's going to be coming. Or we could turn around and move forward and redesign those cities into much more resilient, safer places. And we should be putting all our best brains into that, because I think it is doable. We've got fabulous urban expertise in Australia. Just because of the freewheeling neoliberal system, it hasn't been brought into play. And we don't have proper metropolitan management in Australia. We used to have the Board of Works in Melbourne for a century. We're still living off the wonderful legacy of that organisation, which managed the city well. So those questions come into play. But the social dimension is so important. We're just talking about young people. We need to make them safe. You know, we've got the heat, we've got the pressures coming right at the time where they can't get into acceptable housing. I didn't see that coming 10 years ago, right? What was happening to through a generational thing. So we have to be on a footing on all fronts. But, you know, without getting playing the threats down, I just really wish and urge that we could bring all that expertise into play, have better urban management, metropolitan management, and just move forward rather than keep walking backwards into this what's coming.
Well, I guess this podcast is designed for young people in mind. I had a view that I guess I've been in the industry for quite a while. I won't be around for that much, you know, doing it for that much longer. But I guess what would be your take to a young person listening to this podcast, a young urban designer, a young architect, a person who's interested in sustainability, as so many young people are? I mean, they're not blind to the threat. And I think many that I've met, you know, really anxious and really want to make a difference in this area and really want to find a way that they can make a meaningful contribution. What would be your advice to them?
Well, I would say caucus, collaborate, convene, you know, get together and bring all that wisdom together, but also the sense of urgency with young people can bring. And I have to say a bit of anger is needed at this point to break through. Without getting party political, I think the tussle going on at the national level between the Greens and the federal government over what's happening to the rental sector and younger people in particular and vulnerable population groups it's a break point in our history. So I think
it's been
people to get out and assert and say, you know, there's a real intergenerational theft going on here, but to assert, not just to disappear into a, you know, vortex of anger, but I think a bit of animus and anger. But as I said, caucus, collaborate and convene, get together. I don't mean to sound glib about that, but there's an enormous pool of youthful professional energy. I see it in the urban professions out there, but really broken up and dispersed through the consultancy sector and much smaller state sector now, but they need to find new ways to convene, in my view, and we need to help them.
I know that you have been writing poetry, and I think this sort of segues into what you've just been talking about. You've developed a love of a place near your home called Gardner Reserve, and you've written a book called The Lost property department of Gardiner Reserve, which is a series of poems. And I attended my, well, one of my first poetry readings that you were at, that you were reciting your poems. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's not unrelated to what you've just talked about. Because I think, you know, whilst I understand you as understanding the macro economics of urban design and cities and so forth, you seem to have come back to a place where you can really appreciate place. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it's kind of you to say that, but I think it's also fair in, like many people, you said earlier, the pandemic introduced a new appreciation of place for those that can afford it, right? Those that live in good, warm, secure, and that could suddenly see what a good place I live in. Why am I always commuting out of here? But many people didn't have that. And as we know, lockdown, particularly in poorer suburbs of Melbourne, was a really, it had to happen. Otherwise, we would have many more people died. But we have to understand that really hurt a lot of people and their places. It was a more problematical situation. For me, fortune smiled. I was, you know, at home during the lockdown and got to appreciate this wonderful reserve, little old Victorian reserve that the City of Melbourne's done a magnificent job in recent years of sort of extending and rehabilitating. And it's one of these things where there's so much to learn from it, taking back road space. And they haven't completely designed cars out, but just the roads were just too wide and they were able to take that back and expand the park and do lots of new plantings and just a new children's playground. Eventually we got public toilets in there, which I think are really important. Mm. I was walking here and I saw new public toilets being put in just off Lygon Street by City of Melbourne. I thought, aren't we lucky compared to the UK? We're under the Conservatives' Big Society program. They basically removed all public toilets, right? I began to notice much more around my own local neighbourhood and walking through this beautiful reserve and particularly past the children's playground and seeing the objects that were left behind. We all, you know, children's objects but also other objects left behind. And it made me think, you know, who was the owner? It's a loss. It's about consumption as well. You know, in previous pre-consumer societies, I'm not being critical of us in that sense, but you would have seen much less of this. Objects were not left behind. They were too important. But many of these were lamented and lost objects. So that came to me quite soulfully. And I guess what I would say from that is we can think, yeah, if we have our eyes on the ground, not always in the sky, we can see stuff going on at ground level around us all the time. And it was a time of great human vulnerability and mental health stress. But also I used to hear from my flat the great song of joy of children playing in the playground during the which the council had made possible. It took me back to when my two kids were little. So all those things came together and I guess I gave it poetic expression.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the book. Essentially takes an item that you find and you construct a piece of poetry around, is how I've understood what you've done. But you've also done a little bit with things like Poles Victoria, like you've created these departments, these pseudo municipal departments. Am I correct in saying that?
You are, yeah. So there's two sort of sides, two major sides to the book. One is, so it's called the Loss, not Lost with a T, the Loss Property Department of Gardiner Reserve, which is, and that frames the beginning. There's a corporate overview of this fictitious agency, which sends up all the kind of corporatism and, you know, kind of that all that stuff that goes with contemporary organisations, including in the universities where I've been working. And I mean, to some extent, it's necessary. You know, it's necessary to have a strategic plan. It's necessary to have an ethics officer. But it can also take on kind of whimsical, fantastical dimensions. And so there's a side of that that I've caught in setting up this mythical organisation that runs lost property in this garden. And this, it's a factory of lost property. I mean, I finished that book last year, but since then I've still photographed, you know, like 30, 40 other, you know, it just produces an effusion of lost property. So.
And do you want to just talk a little bit about the studio you ran with architecture students at in relation to this park?
Yes, well, my colleague who's completing or undertaking a PhD at the University of Melbourne, the architect Lauren Adams, has been teaching a studio, a Master of Architecture at RMIT, and convened such a studio in Gardiner Reserve with, and I was, came, you know, 20 metres out of my flat and joined them.
coincidentally?
Oh, no, I was invited. But,
okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I wouldn't have dared. And we passed a few book copies of the book around, but it was a really nice group of people. I haven't been teaching architecture myself, but my guess is that some of them had been out working professionally and coming back and doing masters. So they're really well-informed people, but really warm to the topic of thinking about this ground level, about cities and the everyday and what's around us and the things we don't look at, we look away from, like lost. You know, if you think before I had that sort of epiphany and I realised, and it started off by finding a little girl's sparkly shoes that had been left on a rock at the playground. This was the first poem. And only later I realised they were my daughter's shoes.
Oh, right.
I remember her at that age going through, thankfully, short fairy period. Those, you know, but before that, and then that started, well, what about all these other objects lying around, hats and coats and...
TVs, I presume?
It's shocking what's left behind. Milk crates.
Bicycles, coats.
Yeah, coats, hats. Even improbably a beautifully big macrame knitted throw rug that must have, its owner or creator must have taken a very long time to make, but just left out on a bench.
Freestanding stove, I notice.
Yes, that's right. All sorts of things. But before that, I would have just looked away or not thought about it, whereas I started to think, well, this is part of our urban everyday life. It tells us things about the way we relate to commodities, but also use values, to use that Marxian distinction between exchange value, the commodity, but also these were loved objects in many, some of them were not. They were cast aside, and there's a sadness about that, right? Poor Mr. Crate isn't feeling great. Upended, unfriended, and clearly losing weight.
Well, I'm going to suggest, and I'm sort of going to throw it to you, that you maybe conclude with a poem, because I think it's a nice way. If I've understood anything from our discussion, it's that despite the challenges, having a sort of an eye for the local and for sort of your own sort of domain, I mean, at least in my mind, gives me a little bit of hope about where we're going, you know, and you know, something like Gardner Reserve and the fact that it had been redesigned and rebuilt has probably provided a lot of pleasure for a whole lot of people. And if we can kind of, you know, the challenges that we face are so vast, but if we sort of act at a kind of local level, like for instance this weekend I'm off to a local parkland to help clean litter, which I'm, you know, perhaps wouldn't have done, you know, 5 years ago, but now I think, well, why wouldn't I do it? Why can't I do it? Why shouldn't I do it? You know, so that ability to act more in your local area to sort of encourage change and meet other people who are like-minded seems to me a good way forward from what I can see.
Yeah, I'll just make one quick... I agree with all that. I mean, a red thread running through here is children, right? You would know as a parent that when you had a toddler and then they go, going for a walk was suddenly, oh, my God, it takes forever because they want to stop and look at everything, right? Then they realise you have to relax and you have to start becoming like them, going along at that tottering ground level, but looking at everything. Most things are interesting, you know, and we lose that as we become adults.
That is true. So would you like to choose a poem and we'll conclude our podcast for this session?
All right, just opening randomly. Here's one. The picture is of, amazingly, these angel wings that were left, fluffy feathered angel wings, a set that were left by the road near Gardner Reserve. And this is a very brief poem I wrote. It has a Freudian cast about it, but I'll leave that to the listeners. All right, so we're looking at these white, fluffy angel's wings just lying on the side of the road. Small, for a small bird, for a child. Roadside ode. When an angel boy loses his wings, creation sings with joy at his rebirth. It was time to walk the earth.
Well, thank you, Brendan, and thank you very much for participating in my little podcast. And I hope the listeners, I'm sure the listeners will appreciate your insights. And really, really grateful that you've taken the time to spend talking about these issues.
Thanks, Anthony. It's a great privilege to be asked to come in and talk. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.